Hey, everybody, this is Sonny. I just want to pull the curtain back on the show a little bit. We generally tape on Monday for a Tuesday show. Usually not a big deal in the world of entertainment, not a hassle at all. But in the midst of a fast-moving conflict like what's going on in Russia and Ukraine, it can cause some problems. So, for instance, this week we talked about the possibility that Netflix might not comply with Russian requirements to air propaganda on their networks. They refused to do so last night, so we'll see where that story goes from there. We also discussed the possibility that Warner Brothers could pull The Batman from the release schedule, which is something that just took place as I'm recording this update on Monday night. So there are a few things we discuss in this that are have been slightly overtaken by events, but it's still an interesting conversation. Hope you enjoy it. And if you have any questions, hop into the comments if you're a Bulwark Plus member. I'll tackle them all there. Welcome back to Across the Movie Aisle, presented by Bulwark Plus. I am your host, Sonny Bunch, culture editor of The Bulwark. I'm joined, as always, by Alyssa Rosenberg of The Washington Post and Peter Suderman of Reason Magazine. Alyssa, Peter, how are you today?
I'm swell.
I'm happy to be talking about movies with friends.
First up in controversies and non-controversies, war rages in Ukraine as Vladimir Putin's ugly and illegal invasion of a sovereign state continues despite condemnations around the world and a tightening economic noose. Even the notoriously neutral Swiss have suggested that they may be on the verge of freezing Russian assets. Netflix, meanwhile, is faced with a difficult choice of its own. The streaming giant has a modest presence in Russia, somewhere between 200,000 and 1 million subscribers, as best as I can tell from several minutes of Googling and pinging random friends like the entertainment strategy guy. But it's large enough to fall under a recent law requiring streaming services to carry 20 Russian propaganda channels, including Channel 1, NTV, and a channel run by the Russian Orthodox Church. Meanwhile, politicians in Russia have been targeting Netflix for disseminating, quote, gay propaganda, end quote. Given that the streamer's big award season movie this year is The Power of the Dog, a movie about gay cowboys trying to find their place in the West, one can imagine this is a minor problem for the streaming service. Netflix is in a tough spot. Look, on the one hand, Reed Hastings has positioned himself and his company as a defender of free speech during the various efforts to get Dave Chappelle and his specials removed from the streaming service, or the fight over anti-child sexualization film Cuties that was classified by Know Nothings here in the United States as child pornography. On the other hand, Netflix is no stranger to censoring itself when the need arises, as it has done in Saudi Arabia and elsewhere. Still, it feels like being forced to carry Russian propaganda in the midst of Russia waging a war that turns it into a pariah state on the global stage is a bridge too far. Hollywood in general, not entirely sure how to handle the whole thing. Even as calls mount for Russia to be isolated, Warner Brothers announced it remains set on releasing The Batman. Russia's film market, not small. No Way Home grossed nearly $45 million there. The Batman will probably do something similar. And given that China's hesitance to allow Western films into theaters, the studios are going to be loath to give up any more revenue from foreign territories, no matter how problematic those territories are. Other orgs, less hesitant. Even the notoriously corrupt FIFA has banned Russia from World Cup qualifying. Alyssa, wouldn't it be a relatively low-cost, relatively high-profile PR win for Netflix to tell Russia to just, you know, get stuffed?
I think the problem is that if Netflix starts telling Russia to get stuffed, where does it draw the line? And that is a business problem for Netflix, if not a, you know, the obvious moral win it would seem to be, because Netflix and the other streamers have gotten caught up in a problem with what Wall Street expects from them, totally separate from what audiences expect, is just constant growth, right? And Netflix doesn't operate in China, which has helped it avoid a lot of the sort of more challenging and uncomfortable decisions that other studios have faced in terms of trying to get content to play there. But it needs to keep growing, and so it needs to play in the rest of the world, especially as it's starting to hit a ceiling on the growth that's possible in the United States. And so Netflix has, it's played by Saudi Arabia's rules. It's, you know, now in a position where it may be forced to play by Russia's rules if it wants to continue operating there. And given the global retreat of democracy, it's hard to know where the markets are where Netflix can both grow and stand up internationally for the values it claims to represent at home. And, you know, more broadly, I think that the entertainment industry is a very good example of the way a major assumption of the 90s has proven to be wrong. And there was this sense that in the 90s, that trade more broadly would help spread American values at home, that opening our markets to trading partners like China, encouraging things like NAFTA, would end up spreading American values abroad along with our money. And it has not really worked out that way, most spectacularly in China, which has welcomed in a lot of American industry, cloned it, and then tried to shove out American competitors or outcompete them. But the entertainment industry is specifically supposed to be an industry that not just passively, but explicitly spreads American values abroad. And instead of spreading those values particularly effectively, as authoritarianism has been on the march, the entertainment industry has ended up having to play by other countries' much more restrictive rules in order to get even their most anodyne content in front of those markets. And so the whole sort of moral justification for greater trade integration has been turned on its head, and nowhere more spectacularly than in an industry that was supposed to be an explicit emissary for American values. So Netflix's problem is really a much larger sort of moral existential problem for American capitalism, which is why I think it's a hard decision for the company.
Peter, capitalists have risen to the occasion here, it seems like. You have Elon Musk sending Starlink terminals out. You know, the oil companies are cutting off their partnerships with Russia and Gazprom and other areas and other venues. I just think it's a bad look here for Netflix. I feel like they're trading not very much revenue for, not standing up for their values if they allow this to go forward. We should be clear. By the time this goes live, this whole segment could be out of date because Netflix could have said, no, we're not going to do this thing on March 1 that you want us to do, Russia.
So Netflix could theoretically do this and lose, as you said, not much revenue. But that's not much revenue in the present. And I think that the thing here is what Alyssa said, which is they're looking for expansion. And because right now they have a small subscriber base in Russia, they would like to preserve the option to grow that subscriber base in the future, because there are a lot of people in Russia who could theoretically pay for a Netflix subscription. And so that, to me, seems like the kind of bare-bones business calculus, is that they are not – is that Netflix doesn't necessarily want to cut themselves off from a potentially lucrative market when their investors and their business model expects them to grow. But I actually want to sort of – I don't know if I want to take issue with something that Alyssa said, but I want to sort of question it a little bit, which is this idea that Alyssa is not wrong, that a lot of people thought in the 1990s that trade would export American values, and it hasn't worked out exactly like people thought. But I do think it has worked in one way, which is that it has exported the American value of making money under whatever system you have and, like, finding a way to work within it. And in some ways, like, you talked about, like, well, you know, this is not great for American capitalism, but there is something sort of open to working with whatever the rules are, wherever we are, about American capitalism. In some ways, the essence of it is that we're not going to take a moral stand on things. Our position is our job is to make money. Our job is to sell you stuff, whether that's the NBA or whether that's Disney movies or whether that's Netflix subscriptions to Russians. That's what we do. And so that is what America has successfully exported, is the idea that, you know what? Our business isn't to tell you how to run your country or to determine, you know, to represent the values of the West. Instead, our business is to do our business, which is to make money. And if we cut ourselves off from your market, we won't do that. So maybe we won't do that. Now, I'm not taking a position on, I think that's a great thing. I have mixed feelings about this, but I do think the value that capitalism exports in some ways is the value of finding a way to do business under whatever system.
Alyssa, is that the value that America tells itself it exports? That is not the value that I remember hearing when we're talking about Levi's on USSR butts.
I did start by saying that I don't think it has worked out the way people thought it would in 1997. But in some sense, that's the value that capitalism actually sort of works under, right? Is like, let's find a way to do business. Because that's what Netflix wants to do. That's what Disney wants to do.
So what you're conceding, Peter, is that capitalism is completely amoral and that we should really throw it over in favor of more just system. No, I mean, I'm just talking about what the argument was for all of these free trade deals in 1997, 1999. Bill Clinton and even Republican leaders in Congress were making the argument that capitalism sort of inherently transmitted, like a very effective virus, sort of a broader form of, you know, democratic participation and social liberalism, and that this is why it was a good thing, that, you know, doing more trade with China and introducing, you know, making capitalism more functional there was going to open up human potential and thus let 1,000 flowers of individualism bloom or whatever. And that just obviously has not happened.
I agree it hasn't happened, but I would just sort of flip this back to you as a question.
Sure.
You cut yourself off from those markets. You pull Hollywood out and Western, the Western culture industry, which we're just going to call Hollywood, out of China and out of Russia. Then you're definitely not communicating with them. That is in some ways a kind of a hostile act, right? Even if it's, yeah. I don't mean a warlike act, but it presents as a hostile act to Russian and Chinese culture, or to any other country that you would say we're not going to do business there. And that means that you're going to have even less influence. So sure, I totally agree that Hollywood's trade with China has not created an obviously more democratic and free China. It would be foolish for me to try to argue that point. At the same time, if you pull out of it completely, you're going to influence the country even less. You're going to lose what leverage you might have.
Yeah, and I'm not saying you should. I just think that the bargain has been inverted, right? I mean, what the American entertainment industry exports is the most sort of timid, bland version of our values, in part because the polarization stopped being that people in these other countries were necessarily desperate for the purest expressions of the American idea, and more that American companies were desperate for the subscription revenue that these countries and ticket revenue that these countries had to provide. And so to a certain extent, I mean, you know, if you look at big blockbuster movie making, Chinese moviegoers are as important or more important than American audiences. That was until China really cracked down on the number of movies that it was starting to allow into the country. And so I'm not saying that folks should pull out and give up all influence. I think there is some virtue to maintaining access in at least some of these countries, although the situation with Russia is different from the sort of slower shift of what's happening with the U.S. and China. It's more morally urgent. But, you know, I think the question is, what is it that we're actually exporting, and how did the industry that loves to talk about how it stands up for a certain kind of American values, how did it allow itself to get in a position where those values are not front and center, even necessarily expressed really at all in the storytelling?
Let me just make one more sort of complicating argument here, which is that, you know, what I said was the value that is being exported is the value of doing business under whatever system you happen to be under. But along with that is the value of being a richer and wealthier society. And so the advance of global trade and the interconnectedness of the global economy has coincided with the steepest drop in global poverty, especially in developing countries, but also in places like China, which had a very poor population throughout the 20th century. And part of that is becoming much more linked into the Western global economy. And to me, that is, independent of China's political values, having a larger middle class, having people who have lives that are longer and wealthier, is a moral good that has been born of international trade. And in part, that's because companies, in particular American companies, have been willing to do places in business in places like China and Russia.
Yeah, and I agree. And I would, for anyone who's listening who isn't familiar with his work, I would hugely recommend New York writer Peter Hessler's books about his time teaching the Peace Corps in China and then subsequently covering the country, which coincided with a lot of this economic integration and development. And he actually has a really great new piece in The New Yorker about the students of his who went into business sort of in the couple of decades after he taught them, that I think gets at some of the larger dimensions of this conversation and the relationship between, such as it is, between, you know, business and entrepreneurialism and sort of a broader human expansiveness in a way that's really interesting. His stuff is great.
I do think there's a separate timeliness question here that Alyssa kind of hinted at, which is that, look, this is an immediate emergency. that is calling for, you know, global unity across whatever countries, businesses, etc. I mean, do we think they're... Let's set aside the question of Netflix in China. Let's just look at the Batman, right? So the Batman comes out next week. It's going to be a huge movie around the world, everywhere it opens probably. Somebody tweeted, you know, oh, America, Warner Brothers should do, you know, the most damaging thing it could do, the like serve the biggest, shot across the bow that they could and pull Batman from the Russian release calendar. Everybody made fun of him for this, but I do think that there is a nugget of an idea there. I don't think it is unreasonable for Hollywood studios to say, we are going to partake in a sort of economic boycott and we are going to contribute to the isolation that Russia and its people feel right now.
This is an area where I struggle a little bit because it is clear that there is at least some disconnect between some of the Russian people and their government here. And well, I am all for the World Judo Federation or whatever, you know, stripping Vladimir Putin of his honors within that organization. I do wonder if, you know, denying the Russian people the Batman is not the most effective move, in part because, you know, I think that one of the best things that America could do right now is to make it clear that, like, the individual Russian people are not our enemies. To, you know, I would love it if the Biden administration would open a flood of visas for any Russians who want to come here. I mean, same with Ukrainian refugees, obviously, but, you know, any talented Russians who are terrified at what they're and horrified at what their country is doing, bring them here. And so there's a geopolitical case to be made for trying to balance out damage and to an isolation of the Russian regime and sort of petty damage to the Russian people, right? I mean, this is a somewhat different situation than the international isolation of South Africa under the apartheid regime, where you had a lot of white South Africans who enthusiastically supported that regime. And so, you know, is denying the Russian people the Batman about stopping war in Ukraine, or is it about Warner Brothers feeling good about itself, right? And that, especially in an era where so much of American political conversation is defined by what people think makes them look good, trying to be clear-eyed about what does the most good for Ukrainians who are suffering right now, for Russians whose family members are being sent to fight in a war that, you know, is really hideous and scary and awful. Just trying to separate out what the actual highest and best use of American cultural power is, I think, is a useful exercise in this moment.
So, Peter, we should take the yachts and give them to Christopher Nolan for Tenet 2 from the Russian plutocrats.
Oh, but yes.
Let the people see the Batman.
I'm in favor of the yacht crashing.
I want a movie about the Ukrainian boat mechanic who sank his plutocrat boss's yacht, right?
I mean, do think Christopher Nolan has been weirdly prescient on some of this, right? His last movie, Tenet, was about a Russian oligarch with a death wish and, nuclear weapons who, boy, that's disturbing. And his next movie is about the invention of the atom bomb.
Everyone should pay attention to Christopher Nolan. All right, so what do we think? Is it a controversy or a non-controversy? The Netflix has yet to separate, at the time of this taping, has yet to separate from Russia in the face of being forced to carry Russian propaganda. Alyssa?
American capitalism is controversial, Sonny.
Peter?
Government requirements for carrying propaganda are controversial.
Both of those are correct. So, yes, controversy. A quick programming reminder. Rather than posting both episodes of Across the Movie Aisle on Tuesday, as we had been doing, we're spreading the love a little bit. Main episode's going to go up on Tuesday. This one you're listening to right now on Tuesday, because you've subscribed and you've shared and you've rated and all that stuff, right? They're going to be available on the Substack, your preferred podcast app, iTunes, Spotify, whatever. A bonus episode will go up on Fridays, and it will continue to only be available to members of Bulwark Plus. So go to atma.thebulwark.com and get signed up if you want that special members-only bonus episode. This week, we're talking about the disastrous box office for Peter Dinklage's Cyrano and what that means for the state of the modern musical. Spoiler, nothing good. All right, on to the main event. Coda Streaming now on Apple TV+, which picked the film up for a record $25 million at Sundance, the title is an acronym standing for Child of Deaf Adults. Amelia Jones stars as Ruby Rossi, the daughter of Fisherman Frank, who's played by Troy Kotsur, and former beauty queen Jackie, played by Marley Matlin. And she is also the younger sister of Leo, who's played by Daniel Durant. Leo, Frank, and Jackie are all deaf, while Ruby can hear. Needless to say, this is hard for all of them. Ruby was bullied in school as a younger child because she talked, when she talked, she sounded like a deaf person. She has to serve as the translator for her family at the local fish market, and she has to put up with the constant racket while trying to get homework done or have friends over. Ruby has no real plans for life after high school, aside from helping her family, until she joins the school's chorus. And the teacher running the program, Bernardo Villalobos, who is played by Eugenio, I cannot pronounce his last name, Derbez, takes a shine to her. Will she win the love of the cute boy that she's chasing? Will she get accepted to the prestigious Berklee College of Music? What will happen to her family and their nascent fish-selling business if she's not there to translate for them anymore? All this and more in two very earnest hours. Coda is a perfect example of uncut weapons-grade festival schmaltz. The family in question is quirky. They're deaf. Mom and dad still like to have sex, and it's awkward because they're real loud when they do it. The lead is attractive and has a beautiful voice, yet people still make fun of her in high school, and she is the underdog as a result. She has a horny friend. The teacher inspires young people to find themselves in the arts. It's part Little Miss Sunshine, part Half Nelson, part Whiplash, but a little bit nicer, by way of the TV show Glee. I don't know. I didn't hate Coda. But it is certainly a little bit cloying, question mark? I don't know. Peter, what did you make of the Sundance Darling?
So I was a band nerd in high school in the 1990s, which meant that a couple of times a year, the band director would have to be out for some reason or another. And inevitably, a substitute teacher would arrive and would not know how to teach people how to play instruments. And so what this substitute teacher would always do, 100% of the time in my memory, I have not fact-checked this, but that's how it plays in my head. What this substitute teacher would always do would be to put on Mr. Holland's Opus. And so I saw 50 minutes of Mr. Holland's Opus several times a year, and sometimes 2 50-minute chunks of Mr. Holland's Opus because I was in the band room a lot because I was a band nerd. And this movie reminded me so much of Mr. Holland's Opus, which is to say that it is reasonably well made for what it is. It's kind of winning. It's extremely earnest. And it's just not for me. I just, I just couldn't bring myself to sort of come along with this movie's vision of sort of cute, earnest winningness, like winning people who are struggling against whatever to find their dreams. It didn't work for me in part because it felt so calculated. And there's something here, like this movie sort of follow, like it, there's no point in this movie where any of the characters surprise you. There's no point in this movie where any of the characters sort of do something that's unexpected. It's all a little bit too pressed and clean and ironed and tidy, right? And in some ways, it reminded me of King Richard in that respect, I think, except without the Will Smith John Bernthal performances, which were just a little bit better than King Richard is, than the movie, right, and sort of elevated that film. And the performances weren't bad here. There was no actor who I was like, man, this actor is not doing a good job. And in fact, the performances by the deaf family members, I mean, the deaf actors, like, really quite good. And that's a challenging thing to do to sort of translate, I think, for, into a movie that is aimed at a wide audience. And yet, the fact that it felt like it sort of had to do all of this through, you know, sort of perky, glee-loving, like, the level of earnestness here just wasn't for me, and yet I can't bring myself to, like, really hate, you know, to hate or criticize this movie too much. It's just, like, that sort of thing doesn't appeal to me. There's always something darker and more difficult at work in life than a movie like this presents.
Well, I mean, hating this movie would be like kicking a puppy. Like, it would be like
puppies.
You know,
they're cute.
And everyone likes puppies. We should note that Coda won Best Ensemble at the SAG Awards. Yeah. this weekend. It's getting a lot of buzz. It is nominated for Best Picture. It has an outside shot of winning Best Picture, I think. I don't think it's a favorite by any stretch, but winning Best Ensemble at SAG is not nothing. Alyssa, what did you make of Coda? This feels more like an Alyssa movie than a Peter or a Sonny movie.
I was going to say, I feel so sad for the two of you that you are so immune to joy. It breaks my heart. I love you two so much. And yet, you know, there are just certain life experiences you aren't capable of.
I have lots of joy in my life. Every time Batman growls and punches somebody, I'm just like, yes!
More on that next week.
Yes, indeed. I like this movie a lot, and there were a couple of things that particularly stood out to me about it. The first is I thought it did a really lovely job of getting at the distinct expressiveness of American Sign Language as a language. And, you know, we talked about The Sound of Metal on this show probably about a year ago, and that was a movie we all liked a lot. And that is a movie that is more explicitly about someone who is not born deaf, who becomes deaf, and is trying to decide between his love of music and participation in the deaf community in a way, you know, where there is a really stark choice between, you know, getting cochlear implants and continuing to hear something versus staying in this community that has its own distinct culture, but that doesn't allow you to bridge the divide. And this movie, I actually think, does a somewhat better job of getting at the ways in which ASL, you know, has its own idioms and expressiveness in a way that's really, you know, sort of beautiful and warm and funny and obscene. You know, this is a funny movie. The characters, you know, one of the things that is nice about watching it is that the deaf characters get to be fully people, right? I mean, they're not pathetic. They're not saintly. They're prickly. They're irresponsible in some ways. They have descended into learned helplessness. But for me, the scene that really made the sort of distinctive loveliness of ASL stand out was the moment when Ruby's teacher asks her to explain what singing feels like to her. And even though singing is so transporting and important to her, the only language she can express it in, you know, the feeling in fully, is in by turning to ASL. And the movie is quiet. It doesn't have her speak. It doesn't even have her translate what she's signing. It just lets the power of her gesture and her facial expression work together. So even if you don't understand the sort of explicit words that she's saying, you get this incredibly powerful sense of what it means to her to sing. And I thought that was just really beautifully done. And just getting a sense of the whole sort of argot and expressiveness of the language and just seeing it spoken for so much of the movie, I thought was really well done. I also think this is a movie that hits me probably better than it does the two of you because I am from Boston, from the Boston area. And this, I think, handles the sort of geography and culture of Boston well in some specific ways. I mean, the Berklee College of Music is a really outstanding music school. Some of my friends from high school went there, and they are astonishingly talented people. It's a big deal to get in. And, you know, Gloucester, where Ruby's family is based, where they fish from, you know, the Boston area doesn't look big if you look at it on a map. Certainly if you're from a state like Florida, if you're living in Texas, it all seems sort of small and close together. But the geographic and psychological distance between, you know, fishing communities in towns like Gloucester and in Boston and the sort of class signifiers and differences there are really big. And so this is a movie about Ruby not just crossing the line between the deaf community and the hearing one, but effectively stepping away from her family as a matter of class, as well as hearing ability. And the movie doesn't lean on that as much. But, you know, even in little things like, you know, Ruby getting to the audition and seeing that she's not sort of dressed according to the internal code that all of the other kids seem to have absorbed. You know, I think it's just subtly and nicely handled. And I'm probably a little bit more alive to those distinctions from having grown up in that area. But it struck me as part and parcel of the movie being attentive to detail in a nice and impressive way that these kind of schmaltzy indie darlings don't always pull off. And so, yeah, I found it really charming. And the thing is, like, life is predictable sometimes, right? I mean, Peter, you're saying like there's always something darker there. And that's just not true, right? Like, sometimes people struggle a little bit with decency, but are fundamentally decent people, right? I mean, and, you know, the movie, there is that episode where Miles, Ruby's, the boy Ruby has a crush on and who, you know, is into her, you know, tells a story about, you know, Ruby catching her parents having sex when he's over at his house. And, you know, he knows he's done something wrong, right? It ends up spreading because of course it does. And Ruby gets made fun of again in, you know, a cruel, ugly way. And the person who's the agent of it is the boy she likes, that she, you know, who she followed into choir in the first place. And so there are these sort of little human meannesses in the movie, right? I mean, the, you know, Ruby's family is like constantly at risk of getting cheated because, you know, the guy who runs the local clearinghouse for the fishermen in Gloucester knows they can't hear. And unless Ruby's around, we'll quote them lower prices than he quotes the other fishermen because he knows he can get away with it. I mean, this is a movie that's not devoid of sort of ugliness or meanness. And Peter, in fact, you should be highly in favor of this movie because it's about how government regulation of fishing is ableist. But it, you know, it's not cruel or dark, and that's okay. They're like, the little dramas of our lives are still worthy of dramatization. And, you know, small victories are as worth celebrating as saving Gotham or whatever.
Not totally sold on that. But Peter, she does raise a good point. This is a movie about how bureaucracy is bad.
I appreciated that. No, I mean, it's not dwelled upon, but it's an interesting conflict that to insert into a film like this, which is that this is a systematic issue that that their family has to deal with. And again, it's not like I just found this movie unwatchable. It's not like I found it unpleasant. In some ways, it's a little too pleasant, right? It sort of goes down too easy for me. And your comparison with Sound of Metal, I think, is the right one, which is a movie I really just liked much better. Now, obviously, it's a somewhat different type of film about a, you know, about somebody who loses his hearing rather than somebody who is, you know, didn't have hearing from birth. But that one just sort of seemed to me to be a little more textured with real difficulty and with the ambiguity of life rather than sort of the problems that open up and then develop and then resolve all kind of neatly, more or less. And that sort of thing always, it's the Sound of Metal's worldview, I think, always resonates with me just a little bit more, but also that style of storytelling where problems are hard. There's not an easy answer, and it's not going to all necessarily work out perfectly in the end, but you still have to find some way to make a life for yourself.
I think we're all kind of hitting at something similar here, which is that this movie feels almost old-fashioned.
Yeah.
Like, it feels like a fairly straightforward, old-fashioned, indie festival, award season type movie that is not overly complicated, that is designed to please, that highlights a marginalized community and that broadens our perspective on the world, et cetera, et cetera. But it is just, it really is just kind of either delightfully or unfortunately old-fashioned in its approach.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think you guys are both sort of undercounting some of the rougher edges. I mean, the scene where, you know, Ruby's mom tells her that when she was in the hospital, when she was born, she prayed Ruby would be born deaf. You know, it's a really kind of interestingly, I think, kind of painful thing to see in a movie like this from Ruby's perspective. There's a really great book by an author named Andrew Solomon called Far From the Tree, and it's about children who are radically different from their parents and what that does to the parent-child relationship. And it's interesting to see a sentiment like that expressed on screen, because I think that's something that's hard for a lot of people to comprehend. Like, why would you want your kid to be born deaf? Why would you want them to have to deal with that sort of difficulty? And Sound of Metal does a good job of expressing, of sort of showing us the deaf community as kind of a chosen community, but not necessarily one that people are sort of born into and perpetuate. And both Solomon's book, parts of it are about, you know, what does it mean to be born deaf of deaf, which is the term for used within the community for children, deaf children of deaf adults. And, you know, can you ever fully enter into that culture if you don't grow up learning ASL, if you aren't brought up in ASL? you know, what are sort of the tensions there? And Sound of Metal, you know, does a good job of getting at that chosen community, but not at the way that you're born into it. I have a friend who has dwarfism, whose kids have dwarfism. Two of her three kids have dwarfism. And that community has been incredibly important to her and to her family over the years. And, you know, it's, I think, not something that's always visible to outsiders, but, you know, that question of wanting your kid to be like you and then finding it painful when they're not, even if the way in which they're not like you would seem to be an advantage. You know, it's, again, it's not something that the movie dwells on a lot. It's expressed, you know, most strongly in that one conversation. But again, that's like an interesting and spikier sentiment than I think you guys are necessarily giving the movie credit for.
I think that where this movie excels absolutely is in the parent-child relation stuff. And this is you know, again, a function of me being ruined after having children and being forced to feel emotions when children and parents are on screen. That scene's good. The other little bit that I liked was when the mother asks, if I was deaf or if I was blind, would you be a painter?
Yeah.
As if the, you know, this is all a reaction against, you know, it's just typical teenage rebellion, you know?
Yeah. I mean,
which is not, look, it's a very nicely done movie. Nobody's disputing that, Alyssa.
Yeah. I mean, I do think for, you know, this scene where Ruby's at this concert and her parents and her brother can't hear what's happening and are trying to figure out whether she's good or not is nicely and interestingly, you know, shot and acted, right? Because they're not necessarily behaving in a way that's like attentive or polite. They're trying to sort of interpret. It's just like, it's this inevitably awkward situation, right? And I think that competence is underrated, and this movie is very competent in ways that are small, but that add up to a lot over the course of the movie. And Marlee Matlin is a hoot in this. I mean, I think she and Troy Kotsur are both just great in this in ways that I really appreciated.
Yeah, I love Troy Kotsur in particular. Marlee Matlin, always great. There's a reason. She is as popular as she is. Peter, any parting thoughts before we get to the thumbs up, thumbs down?
Let's just get to thumbs up, thumbs down.
All right. So what do we think? Thumbs up or thumbs down on Coda? Alyssa?
Thumbs up because I want everyone to know Joy.
Peter?
Thumbs up, actually, even though it's not for me. But I think it's well enough made movie that, like, I can't give this a thumbs down. It is absolutely the movie that it set out to be, and it's done well at every turn, and it's also just not really a movie for me.
Thumbs up, because I like to pet puppies, not kick them. All right, that's it for this week's show. If you loved it, make sure to check out our members-only bonus episode coming Friday to atma.thebulwark.com on the death of the modern musical, and make sure to tell your friends. A strong recommendation from a friend is basically the only way to grow podcast audiences. If we don't grow, we will die. If you did not love today's episode, please complain to me on Twitter at SunnyBunch. I'll convince you that it is, in fact, the best show in your podcast feed. See you guys next week.